Gonna tell you a story not long ago. High on a mountain in Idaho, in Idaho, I was living free. Sold a sawed-off shotgun to a deputy.
Don't shoot me down.
Don't shoot me down.
Don't shoot me down.
Don't shoot me down.
Got a wife and kids on Ruby Ridge. Please don't shoot me down.
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 Got a wife and kids on Ruby Ridge.
Please don't shoot me down.
My good dog killed my boy, my only son, my pride and joy. They shot my wife dead on the floor, holding our baby in the cabin door.
Don't shoot me down.
Don't shoot me down.
Don't shoot me down.
Don't shoot me down.
Got a wife and kids on Ruby Ridge.
Please, please don't shoot me down.
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 Got a wife and kids on Ruby Ridge.
Please don't shoot me down. And you want to go build a cabin in Idaho, in Idaho. If you're living free, boys, don't sell no shotgun, no deputy.
Don't shoot me down.
Don't shoot me down.
Don't shoot me down.
Don't shoot me down.
Got a wife and kids on Ruby Ridge.
Please, please don't shoot me down.
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 Got a wife and kids on Ruby Ridge.
Please, please don't shoot me down.
Good evening, this is Truth Quest, and with Melody and Eric. And that was Eric Carlstrom with the song Ruby Ridge that he performed with his on his album Bluegrass Conspiracy. And is that Jason that was your...
Yeah, that's a fellow professor. I don't know if you've got me on there. Have you got me on now?
Yeah.
Fellow professor where I teach, he's a philosophy professor, so we have a little bluegrass group that we where we put songs like that out. Yeah.
Well, tonight we have a special show tonight with Deneen Peterson. Are you there, Deneen?
Yes, I am. Oh, okay. I can barely hear you.
Okay, we're going to have the same problem we had last time, it sounds like, and I've got to figure out how to get the... Is that any better? Do you hear me any better?
Not really.
Not really?
You know, I can hear you, but I have to really concentrate, too.
Okay. Yeah.
You speak right into it. Yeah.
All right. And so, well, Deneen Peterson.
Am I loud and clear?
Oh, yeah. You're just fine.
Okay.
It may take playing with this board a little bit because it's a little bit antiquated, so... We just kind of work with what we've got. So, anyways, this is KHENLP 106.9 Salida. And, again, and, I want to go in before we get into the interview tonight, which with Deneen is the opinions expressed by the host and guests on this show do not necessarily represent the views of KHEN, its staff, or board of directors. Okay, and Deneen is an author who writes and speaks about the North American Union, and her articles are published on a variety of online news, journals, and chronicles, and is heavily researched and referenced by with clickable URLs that will take the reader directly to the source material. Her accompanying photos and graphics add to her vivid exposés. All of her articles can be found archived on Stop the American North American Union website, .com website. And my co-host tonight is Eric Carlstrom. And I'll go ahead and let you go ahead and get started with Deneen here.
Okay, I just had a chance to talk a little bit with Deneen Peterson. She is a PhD. She has a PhD degree, and now she tells me she has moved into the realm of volunteer work, having had an interesting background in several fields. Deneen, if I can call you that, could you just tell us a little bit about your background before we get into the substance of what you're doing now?
Sure, I'd be glad to. I started out in the corporate world. I worked for several major corporations. Then I got married. My husband and I had an entrepreneurial business life. At the same time, I pursued an academic career and ended up with a PhD, and I was taught at two universities, Temple University and Jefferson University in Philadelphia. I then moved out of the academic arena and into nonprofit, and I created their first department of research and program evaluation for Big Brothers, Big Sisters of America, the national office in Philadelphia, where I was responsible for data collection from some 512 agencies in all 50 states, and putting in place programs to, you know, test the efficacy of the Big Brother, Big Sister program. They had none of that before I came there. What I taught at Temple and Jeff was I taught behavioral science research methodology, and I taught statistics. Not too many people like to teach that, but I loved it. And now, in retirement, I say that lightly because I work probably more hours today than I did in any of my four careers. So I'm an activist fighting against the North American Union and the coming totalitarian police state in our country.
Okay, and you have a website, as Melody said, which is, could you give us the name of your website again and tell us about your book as well?
Sure. Mm-hmm. It's StopTheNorthAmericanUnion.com.
And you've written a book recently.
Yes, I have. It's called Treason Abounds. It's named after one of the articles that I did. It's actually a compendium of my articles that have had to be altered somewhat to be in a book because I write primarily for the electronic media. I do it because I have a lot of graphics. Everything, you know, of course, is in color. And the book is called Treason Abounds, A Government Cabal Plots North American Union. And three of the four articles at the top of my website on the homepage are in that book, and a fourth article, which is my lead-in part of the book. It's all in color. It's about 300 and some pages long. It has 177 references in it for you to go check on me in case you don't believe what I say in the book. And the same way on my website, whenever I write, everything is documented. Every quote, every fact, every statistic is documented. It's numbered. You can go down to the bottom of the article and click on that. I have as many as 133 references in one of my articles. And you can go right to the source material and check out what I have to say. So,
well, we sure appreciate you being with us here tonight, Deneen. And obviously the topic that you're most focused in on is the North American Union. And most Americans know little about this, very little, I think. Could you briefly tell us what this is and why we should be concerned about it?
Oh, sure. I'd be glad to. A couple of things. My background prior to diving into the North American Union and the Security Prosperity Partnership Agreement that was signed by Bush and Fox and Martin of Canada in Waco, Texas in 2005, I was an anti-legal alien activist, and all my major body of my work was in that arena. And at one point, I kept saying to myself, why aren't our borders closed after 9/11? Why is our Title 8 United States Code not being enforced, which is the immigration code? And finally, when I really began to understand what the North American Union was all about and the ultimate goal of the North American Union, which is basically a one-world monopoly by a very select few people, I realized why the border was open. The border was open because it creates a de facto erasure of the borders, which is what they need to form the North American Union. And so once I realized that and started to look into the North American Union issue, I actually had to divest myself of thousands of documents hard copies that laid behind my work on the anti-legal alien situation. I have all those articles, by the way, archived on that same Stop the North American Union website so that people can read them. They're still relevant today. But once I started to look into it, I understood the component parts, and even now I learn more and more each and every day about the component parts of the North American Union. One of the things you have to understand about the North American Union is it's been in progress since the beginning of our country, more noticeably done and more out in the open since the turn of the 20th century, beginning with things like in 1913, the creation of the Federal Reserve, and so on. So those are things that are all part and parcel of where we're at today with the creation of the North American Union in our country.
Well, go ahead. Well, I'm quite fascinated with what you said about that this was this idea was somehow anticipated even at the very beginning of our country.
It was.
And how could you tell us why you believe that?
Well, I'll give you a few examples. This one here, first of all, what is happening when you give up your borders is you lose your national sovereignty. And that is, of course, very near and dear to a lot of people. But back in early, and it seems like a lot of things actually happened in the 1930s. I think they really got up ahead of steam starting right in the 30s. Because in the early 30s, the Council on Foreign Relations was formed, which has had an inordinate shadow government type process ongoing in our country, literally running our country behind the scenes. Many presidents, and I'll give you a few quotes on that, many presidents, senators, people from the Supreme Court of our country have all spoken out about the shadow government, people that are really running the country, not the people that you and I see up front. But anyway, this was back in 1931, and this was a statement that was made at a conference by a man by the name of Arnold Toynbee. Now, some people may know that name. He was a Fabian socialist in Britain, or England, or the UK, pick one. He was a Rhodes Roundtabler. Now, this issue of Roundtable is very significant for what I call the shadow government. It's very meaningful to them, and the Rhodes scholarships, which were connected to Rhodes, are also connected to this shadow government. Things like the skull and bones that George Bush belongs to and John Kerry belonged to, and George Bush Sr. belong to, they're all part of the people that are working behind the scenes running our government. And then there's a lot of things, of course, that we've seen just since 9/11, executive orders, signing statements, and that sort of thing, which shows you that things are out of control in the executive branch, but it's far worse than you know, and I will try to reach that, talk about that tonight. But here's what this said. This Arnold Toynbee was also the British Royal Institute for International Affairs, the RIIA, which is the counterpart to the one that they have here in the United States, which is the Council on Foreign Relations. He gave a speech at a conference of institutions for the scientific study of international affairs, and this was done in Copenhagen, and the title of it was The Trend of International Affairs Since the War, and this is what he told the people there at that conference. If we are, this is a quote now, if we are frank with ourselves, we shall admit that we are engaged on a deliberate and sustained and concentrated effort to impose limitations upon the sovereignty and independence of 50 or 60 local sovereign independent states, he's talking about nations, by the way, not states, which at present partition the habitable surface of the earth and divide the political allegiance of mankind. It is just because we are really attacking the principle of local sovereignty, or in our case, national sovereignty, as with the 27 countries in the EU, that we keep on protesting our loyalty to it so loudly. The harder we press our attack on the idol, sovereignty, the more pains we take to keep its priests and devotees in a fool's paradise, lapped in a false sense of security, which will inhibit them from taking up arms in their idol's defense. The local nation state invested with the attributes of sovereignty is an abomination of desolation, standing in the place where it ought not. It has stood in that place now for 4 or 5 centuries. Our political task in our generation is to cast the abomination out. I will not prophesy, I will merely repeat that we are at present working discreetly but with all our might to wrest this mysterious political force called sovereignty out of the clutches of the local national states of our world. And all the time, we are denying with our lips what we are doing with our hands.
That's a great quote, Deneen, and I would just add to what you said that Arnold Toynbee is recognized as being one of the very, very top historians of the 20th century. So this is a brilliant man.
Oh, yes, I know that. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, this is a brilliant man who obviously is in the know on a long-term plan. So, yeah, I just thought I'd throw that in.
Yes, and that usually makes people hair stand on them when they hear that, because they were making statements like that then after a long period of time of building to that point. That didn't just pop out of the bag that day. So here's some other people who have spoken out about what we call in the people that know, understand what's going on in this country, is about the shadow government. This was said by Rear Admiral Chester Ward, United States Navy retired, who was a member of the CFR, the Council on Foreign Relations, for 16 years. And this is what he wrote. The most powerful clique in these elitist groups have but one objective in common. They want to bring about the surrender of the sovereignty and the national independence of the United States. Now, the Council on Foreign Relations, as you recall what I just said, is the sister organization of the Royal Institute for International Affairs, of which Toynbee was the head of. Felix Frankfurter, he was the Justice of the Supreme Court from 1939 to 62. He said, quote, "The real rulers in Washington are invisible and exercise power from behind the scenes." This one came from, it was in a letter to an associate in November 21st of 33 by President Franklin Delano Roosevelt. He wrote the following. "The real truth of the matter is, as you and I know, that a financial element in the large centers has owned the government ever since the days of Andrew Jackson." This one here came from a speech by Senator William Jenner, who warned America, quote, "Outwardly, we have a constitutional government. We have operating within our government and political system another body representing another form of government, a bureaucratic elite which believes our Constitution is outmoded." And then, of course, we heard recently from President Bush, who was in the Oval Office talking about how outmoded our Constitution was when he was requested by the GOP to soft-pedal some of the parts of the Patriot Act when they were up for renewal. And he said, "I don't give a GD. I'm the president and commander-in-chief. Do it my way." responded to him and said, "There is a valid case that the provisions in this law, the United USA Patriot Act, undermine the Constitution," and it does quite a bit. Bush screams back, "Stop throwing the Constitution in my face. It's just a GD piece of paper." Then there's this other last quote, which is really startling. In fact, it's on the cover of my book. There's down in Washington, D.C., there's a monument. There's a park that has been devoted to several, probably a dozen monuments to Franklin Delano Roosevelt. And the latest monument that was dedicated during the Clinton administration, that period of time when Clinton had knee surgery, was hobbling around on crutches and canes and things like that. Well, he dedicated this final memorial in the supposedly the last memorial that will be put in the Franklin Delano Roosevelt Park. And the really stunning thing about it was I read several reviews of that very long reviews, in fact, like in the Washington Post and so on, and there was not a single mention about the inscription that's on the back wall of this monument. Now, this monument shows FDR seated, as he would be because he couldn't stand too well, and he has a cape draped around him, which covers the whole chair, and at his feet is the dog Fala, his favorite Scottish terrier. On the back wall, there's an inscription, which is about, I would guess from the picture, that it's 2 feet by 4 feet, so it's huge. And this is what's written on that inscription. "They, who seek to establish systems of government based on the regimentation of all human beings by a handful of individual rulers, call this a new world order." I added the world. He just said new order. And he goes on to say, it is not new, and it is not order. Now, if that isn't a voice from beyond the grave, I don't know what is. And like I say, it's 2 feet by 4 feet, and wasn't even mentioned in any of the... There's also a travelogue of that park, too, and it doesn't include that inscription in it.
Deneen, when you talk about several, you know, I assume when you're talking about several hundred years, you're talking about even when this country was formed, that we already had a shadow government. Is that what you're kind of saying here?
No, we didn't have a shadow government, but that's when they began work. I mean, right from the very beginning, we were to be an outgrowth of England, and they wanted us controlled. And so people were sent over here to work, and I'm going to tell you this, and a lot of people get upset about it, but they used the cover of the Freemasonry system to do their dirty work behind the scenes. I mean, people who are Masons aren't bad people, but there were people that used their organizational structure and facilities throughout the United States to work in secret and do not nice things. And, of course, you know, a lot of our founding fathers were Masons. It was a way you made business contacts and things like that. But once you went up in degrees in Masonry, then you got closer and closer to the real problem in our country, the real shadow government. So...
Well, I'm quite.
I don't talk about that too much because most people don't understand how it could be, you know, good people in there and then behind the scenes these really bad people. It's very hard to envision, but that's actually where they started. That's where they infiltrated first.
Well, as I understand it from talking to some of the people we've had on recently and from my own reading, that groups like Masons, which is a semi-secret society, and others which are not secret, often have a pyramidal structure so that you have very few people at the top controlling very, very many below them, and the people below may not know what the true agenda is of the people at the top. And I think this describes Masonry quite well.
Yes, that's exactly correct.
So it's a... Yeah, so we may have many, many, many good Masons in this country today, but if the people at the top are steering the ship in a direction they don't know about, well, then there's nothing they really can do about it. So I think
exactly
this has always
right.
been the case.
And you know, to give you a really good example of that, one of the component parts of the North American Union is these transcontinental highways that are being dividing our country in half. The first one, major one, planned that most people know about, is the I-35 corridor going from the ports in lower Mexico, where China will unload its goods and bypass our western ports, chip a lot of people out of their jobs, into Cardenas in a lower tip of Mexico. And they will come up through the country. They'll go up in Texas on what they call TTC-35, Trans-Texas Corridor 35, which is the beginning of the I-35 corridor, which will dissect our country almost in half, and go right straight on out the top of our country and into Canada, then branch out all the way to the east coast and the west coast of Canada. There are actually 80 corridors planned and in motion in this country. Some of the other corridors that you might know out your way is the Canamex Highway and the Ports the Plains. They're not highway, by the way, they're corridors. Ports the Plain corridors is another one. The Canamex Highway comes up through Mexico, goes through Arizona, Utah, I think, I'm trying to think of some of the states, right on up out of the country and all the way up to Alaska. There's also a huge corridor coming in on the west coast of Canada, both at Vancouver and midway between Vancouver and the tip, southern tip of Alaska. It's called the Asia-Pacific Corridor. And they are trying to see if I can find the – there it is. There is this concept about calling people tend to call the TTC-35 or the I-35 corridor, they tend to call it the NAFTA superhighway. That's the generic term that most people use because it's supposed to be an outgrowth of the NAFTA, the North American Free Trade Agreement. Okay? And the interesting part about it is it's not. It's really a corridor. In fact, Dick Cheney came out, just before they went up to Montebello, Canada to have the last of the three annual meetings of the trilateral group, which is our president, Mexico's president, Calderon now, and Canada's president, which Prime Minister, who is a Harper. They met up there in secret, behind closed doors, again, and worked out whatever they were working on. And it turns out that people don't understand these highways are intercontinental highways, and the real term is corridor. Now, just before they went to that meeting, Dick Cheney came out and sort of, and I'm sure having known what it's like to be put down over the truth seekers of 9/11, that he made a mockery out of there is no such thing as a NAFTA superhighway. He's technically right. There is no NAFTA superhighway. It's a NASCO super corridor. And NASCO is a nonprofit organization that's receiving millions of dollars from our government to promote these highways. And these highways are going to be built and turned into toll roads by foreign entities, okay, Spain, Australia, and so on. And these highways, if anybody's as old as I am, they can remember when Eisenhower created these highways to be free roads. Our taxpayer dollars paid for them and built them and maintained them. They're now being sold to foreign entities who are going to turn them into toll roads. Who gives these people the right to do that? Well, executive orders did that under the Clinton administration.
Deneen, do you want to explain what a corridor is and why you keep stating that?
Yes, okay. Yes, I'd be happy to do. I'm going to write a piece on this. I've written individual people about it, but if you go to the dictionary, and this is very typical of what I call the shadow government people, the one-world monopolists, is that they use words that we interpret one way, but they have a hidden, dark meaning to them. Now, here's the definition out of Webster's, and this isn't the number one definition for corridors. This is the number two definition. Quote, a strip of land or an airspace forming a passageway through foreign-held land, as from a country to its seaport, as is the Asia-Pacific Corridor, and as is the TPC 35 and the Canamex Highway. They will all go from ports up through Mexico, through our country, which is foreign land for China and Mexico.
Kind of like the Panama Canal was for Panama?
Oh, my favorite subject. a lot of people, and again, I'm up in years, and I do remember during the Carter administration, when the Panama Canal was turned over to a Marxist dictator, and we paid them $400 million to take it. And I said, what are they doing? All the blood and treasure that the United States put into that cross-cut through there many purposes, militarily and for commerce, why would we give it away and pay a Marxist dictator to take it? Why? Why did they do that? Well, now I know. They already knew. And by the way, let me back up one step. Who was the head of the commission, the Linowitz Commission, that went down there, that convinced our Congress to sign on to this sale, that had the backing of Carter? Who was on that commission? Oh, it was Dr. Robert A. Pastor, the Pied Piper of the North American, he calls it a community, but it's not, it's a union. Back then, they already knew they were going to create these ports in southern Mexico and these corridors through foreign territory through our country. They knew then, back during the Carter administration. That's how far ahead they think and plan.
Well, just to kind of backtrack even further, I was told once that when Ben Franklin came out of the Constitutional Congress, he was asked by a reporter, what have you given us, Mr. Franklin? And he replied, a republic, if you can keep it. And so I think what the thrust of your research is that we've not done a very good job of keeping our republic, and we're quickly morphing into an international trade bloc, which would not only eviscerate but completely throw out our Constitution, and our constitutional rights then would be done and gone. Is this the thrust of what you're saying? If we go
absolutely, you hit the nail right on the head, and it's interesting. This isn't in my book. It's going to be in my next book, which I wrote an article, again, at the top of my homepage on my website, stopthenorthamericanunion.com. It's called the EU and the NAU, two peas in a pod. And I use that rather juvenile-sounding title, two peas in a pod, because it's exactly what they did in the European Union, they're doing here. Now, it took them 55 years to create the European Union. It's only going to take them 15 to create the North American Union. I mean, Robert Pastor's already sat in front of our Congress and said, we're going to have open borders by 2010. And there's been other people that said, we are going to have a North American Union, whether you like it or not.
Well, okay? Certainly I agree that that losing our Constitution, losing our sovereignty is awful, something we should all be resisting as much as we can. But just to play the other side of it, what's the real downside of the EU for most of us in America who don't really understand the impact of the EU on Europe? Could you tell us why this is something we should be very skeptical about?
Oh, sure. First of all, I'm just like most arrogant Americans. I only speak English and read English. I know a little bit of French and a little bit of Spanish, but not much, not enough to read and study. So while I was working on the North American Union, I accidentally stumbled over people who were fighting against the European Union in Britain. And, of course, because I speak English, I could really get into depth with it, and I started doing a lot of research. I actually had another article planned before I started out the EU and the NAU, two peas in a pod. But when I realized that exactly what was done in Britain and the European Union, which is now consists of 27 nations, is exactly what they're doing here, okay, exactly. Dot your I's, cross your T's, exactly. And so I became alarmed, and I started learning more and more and more about what the European Union consists of, how it's structured, who's running it. Well, who's running the European Union is exactly who plans to run the world, which is a plutocratic oligarchy, okay? And to give you one for one, tit for tat, and you use the word morph, it's a wonderful word because it really does explain how they went from one thing to another. But here's the comparison. The European Union began as a coal and steel free trade agreement in 1951. The North American Union began as NAFTA, the North American Free Trade Agreement, in 1994. The EU morphed into, and some of you may remember this name, the European Economic Community, which was shortened to the EEC. And before our U.S. Congress, as I said, CFR member Dr. Robert Pastor, he calls for a North American Community. Well, it's not a community because it's, by definition, not going to be a community. But once the EEC became established, it then morphed into the common market. Now, most people know about the common market. Now that NAFTA is established, it's morphed into the Security and Prosperity Partnership, the SPP. That's a shortened version, SPP, of Security Prosperity Partnership, which is very important for people to study. The SPP.gov website, you can go on it. You can read what's on that website. Of course, they lie on that website, and I point out one of their really big lies on that website, which I'll tell you about in a little bit. But to go on with the progression of how the EU was formed and how they're going to form the NAU, the North American Union. Britain didn't belong in any of this until January of 1973 when they joined the European Union, because that's what the common market then morphed into the European Union. So they joined the common market in 1973, and then after they joined it, and I have a video on my website that talks about the real face of the European Union. It's a documentary. They interview a lot of people that were there in the parliament in Britain in 1973, how the whole thing was sold to them as just signing on to the common market so that they could, you know, trade, you know, just like they sucked us into NAFTA. And then we've lost our shirt over that. And then they sucked us into CAFTA, which is going to make it even worse. If we think we lost a lot of manufacturing and jobs, wait till CAFTA comes under, you know, begins to really roll. But anyway, so they got fooled. And the people that were there and voted for that at that time in 73 is on that, the real face of the European Union, again on my website in the video collection area. And there are two other videos connected to that issue. But they thought they were just joining a common market, okay? But then what happened after they joined? Then it morphed into the European Union. what's happening here, we have first NAFTA, then we have this Security Prosperity Partnership that was signed in March of 2005 by the three heads of state. And, the three heads of state, and that was in March of 2004, and it is now morphing into the North American Union. And how it's morphing, I'll explain again a little bit later how that's happening. Now, the EU already has a single currency. It's called a euro, and they want the single currency here to be called the Amero.
And what has been the negative impact of the EU on the cultural and political life of Europeans?
Oh, it's been horrendous, absolutely horrendous. First of all, the way they create these unions is incrementally. It's also done behind the scenes, behind closed doors, by people who aren't elected. The biggest, most common tool that's used, and it's being used in our country, but most people don't know that, is the what they call harmonization of our administrative or bureaucratic, or most people will know it as regulatory law. Those are all three the same thing, the administrative, the bureaucratic law, and the regulatory law. They're all the same thing. They're just known by different levels of governance by different names. You and I can best understand regulatory law. Now, regulatory law affects everything you do. From the time you get up until you go to bed at night, it affects everything in your life. Good examples of lack of regulatory law is the dog food that China sent us that poisoned our dogs, the toys that they're sending us with lead paint on them, the tires that they send us that blow apart because they're not properly vulcanized, and I forget there was another one recently that they, contaminated fish, I think it was, that came in. Why? Because they're not regulated. They don't have laws governing, restricting the way things can be manufactured and processed and created for human consumption. So we have spent 230-plus years creating our regulatory law that's a function of our society, of our environmental needs, and so on. Canada did the same thing. Mexico did the same thing, okay? So there's these three different sets of laws. Well, what they're doing behind closed doors, and which was mandated at the Security Prosperity Partnership meeting, the very first one that took place in Waco, Texas in 2005, was the agreement to go back to each of their respective countries and set in motion these workforces, these task forces that are tasked at every single level of governance that handles bureaucratic law or regulatory law to change these laws. They're calling it harmonization. In fact, at the meeting up in Montebello, Canada, the big joke was, oh, we're just figuring out, we're dealing with the colors the jelly beans are, or the number of baby food jars. For instance, the United States uses 3-size baby food jars, and Canada only uses 2-size baby food jars. I mean, they're insulting our intelligence is what they're doing.
Well, the fact
so
is,
they have these meetings behind these doors, and they're supposedly dealing with minutia like baby food jars and jelly beans, having to do with regulatory law.
Well, these secret meetings of these political leaders, in fact, are accomplishing the exact same goals of the World Trade Organization, which is to remove all laws that might restrict their unbridled profit taking by the major corporations. And and of course, in our Constitution, it says when you sign an international treaty, that treaty is above the local laws. And by signing on to the World Trade Organization.
Problem.
Yeah.
These treaties have to be ratified. In order for it to be a treaty, it has to be ratified by 2/3 of our Senate. And there was quite a discussion. I'm sorry, I stepped all over you. What was you wanted to say now?
Well, no, I was just kind of pointing out that in secret our government leaders have been advancing the very same agenda as the World Trade Organization,
mm-hmm.
which is this international business body, like mm-hmm. the CEOs of Coca-Cola and ConAgra and GE and Westinghouse. In other words, what you're talking about, this plutocratic oligarchy or this one world monopoly, consists mm-hmm. of the world's major corporations and banks. And
right.
And what they're doing by eviscerating the sovereignty of our country, as well as our ability to regulate our own industries, is removing all competition for these extremely powerful corporations.
Mm-hmm. They actually, Bush came back from that meeting, while I'm sure all the stuff was in motion ahead of time, and the lead executive, every single department in the executive branch, every single one. The lead branch is commerce, which is Gutierrez, and then he's to work hand in glove with two other partners. One is the Department of Homeland Security, and the other one is the State Department. But all the departments are involved in the dumbing down of our regulatory law. They formed task forces. They had goals. They had agendas. They had reporting back. None of this has been in the press. None of this has reached the transparency before our Congress, let alone asking we the people if we think it's okay. They work for us, you know?
Right.
That's what our Constitution said anyway.
Well, yeah, it's interesting that NAFTA was passed in, I think, January 1st, 1994, on a fast track through Congress without any debate and without the American people really knowing what was going on, let alone the congressmen. So we have a...
And look at CAFTA. CAFTA was really defeated. But even after the bell rung for the end of voting, they twisted a few arms and got a couple more votes and cast a pass. You know, they don't even read this stuff. The amnesty bill that came out, several times, the last time it was defeated, it was worked on where? It's not the amnesty bill that was the problem. What were they working on it? They were working on it behind closed doors. They flopped it on the floor to be voted. Nobody read it. That's how they're passing the bills in our country now. But to get back to that same issue, a wonderful thing happened when they had the discussion about the fact that supposedly under NAFTA, they're going to allow Mexican truckers to drive all over our country, even though they don't meet any of the requirements that were agreed to under NAFTA. NAFTA had built into it a pilot,
Sunset clause?
Pardon?
A sunset clause?
No, they had built into it a way for Mexican truck drivers to drive in our country, but there was a whole series of regulations about how that was supposed to happen. But what they did was they renamed it a pilot program, and they're totally overlooking all the regulatory issues that were in the NAFTA agreement and to allow that. That's why since NAFTA was written in 1994, or passed, or signed, they haven't been able to get into our country because they haven't abided by the rules that were in NAFTA for them to enter our country and drive around and deliver cargo. So how did they get around it? Well, President Bush assigned Mary Peters to the Department of Transportation. She's a member of the CFR. She's doing his bidding. And he said, oh, well, let's dream up another name for this. We'll call it a pilot program. And we'll just do an end run around the NAFTA contract. But it was interesting because the senators, I will say this is very rare, the senators did stand up and fight against it. And it was quite a nice article written by Jerome Corsi, who writes a lot. He's he's probably the number one expert on the North American Union. He wrote about what happened there in the Senate when they were fighting against and trying to stop the Mexican trucks from coming in here. But that wasn't the real issue. The real issue was during this huge debate, and it was very acrimonious in the Senate, as acrimonious as they get, and one of the most significant things that came out of that was this quote. It says, repeatedly, this is Corsi's article, repeatedly in arguing from the floor of the Senate for his amendment, Senator Cornyn from Texas, mischaracterized NAFTA as having created a treaty obligation requiring the United States to allow Mexico trucks free access to U.S. roads. Now, why is he saying that? He's saying that because if it's a treaty, it is subjected to international law, not our Supreme Court, but international law, okay, which means that Mexico can sue us and go before an international tribunal, and they can decide to fine us for not allowing Mexico's trucks into our country, okay? Well, you know what? Senator Dorgan called him on it, and he hit the nail right on the head. And this is really the most important part of this article, not that they came out against the truckers, the Mexican truckers. Dorgan objected, pointing out that NAFTA was passed in 1993 as a law, not a treaty. Now, if you look at the definition of the treaty in the dictionary, you will find out that NAFTA is indeed a treaty. But you know what? According to our Constitution, it says if an international agreement is signed for, and again, the definition, one of the three definitions for an international agreement being signed and being called a treaty is that it has to deal with trade, okay? So this was an international agreement. It did involve trade, and therefore it should have been brought before our Senate for the required two-thirds majority vote for it in order for it to have the effect of a treaty. It is not a treaty. It is a law. So we are not subjected to international court and international tribunals.
Where would the UN play into this, Deneen? Does it?
Everywhere they can. I just actually got tonight over the internet an organization out in California. It's got to do with controlling population growth, and they are promoting this $50 million grant to colleges and universities to begin to talk about sustainable development. Well, heavens, that's right out of the United Nations playbook. What are these people thinking? Don't they understand, you know, regionalization and sustainable development and all of that stuff it's all part of the one world government that's trying to tie us down to all of this world stuff.
Well, it sounds like the World Trade Organization is loosening all the regulations initially, and yet the UN, with their Agenda 21, is very, very much the opposite. Am I right? Are you following what I'm saying?
Anything that is created by any agendas that come out of the United Nations are extraordinarily detrimental to us as a sovereign nation, every one of them. If as Ron Paul so clearly says, so, which is why he, you know, impresses me, is the UN would be gone the day after he's in office, and that should be gone because they're a subversive organization. Look, Nelson Rockefeller, who is the godfather of this whole shadow government in the United States, he's not alone, but he's one of what I call the visible parts of the shadow government. His father, John D. Rockefeller, a robber baron, which is why I call them the one world monopolist, because now instead of just being robber barons from the turn of the century, they stuck all their money in these nonprofit foundations because they don't have to pay any taxes on it. And they now have the modern day version, which I call the one world monopolist, because they're not just satisfied with controlling the United States with monopolies. They want to take over the whole world. But his father had two of his sons purchase the land beneath the United Nations for $8.3 million and then submitted a tax return as a contribution. What do they call it? I can't think of it. A nonprofit contribution. So he didn't pay any taxes. He got to save some of his tax payments because he bought this for the United Nations. So who do you think controls the United Nations?
You know,
United Nations is just an official arm of what the one world monopolists have wanted all along. You can go back to the my mind's going.
Oh, the League of Nations was established right after World War
I. That's one of them. There's one even before that. I want to say Trent, but I know that's not it. I can't think of it. Oh, you're a historian. You should know.
I'm a geographer, but, you know.
Oh, that's right. Geography, sorry.
I'm learning more all the time thanks to interviews like this. You know, last week we had Alan Watt on our interview, and he has a website called Cutting Through the Matrix, and he estimates there's about 3,000 people that are really running the world. They are the ones that are really the point people in this plutocratic oligarchy that you talk about.
Mm-hmm.
And it's quite an amazing. And of course, there's lots and lots of evidence for this, and it's lots of evidence over many, many years that this is a long-term, multi-generational strategy on the part of this group that wants to monopolize the world for their own benefit. Now, and it's mind-boggling for most of us to think that there might be some kind of multiple generational plan that has lasted for hundreds of years. What do you suppose gives it its staying power, this New World Order, one world government crowd that has worked from one generation to the next, such as the Bush family? What's the staying power in your estimation?
Well, it's very interesting. Yes, I agree with you. I think the number of people, probably the number of the people top, is closer to 3,000. Of course, there's the 300 that's the real top of the pyramid. But anyway, I do think that it is multi-generational. It has been for centuries, actually. And they're behind all the major wars because they make money on both sides. The Council on Foreign Relations, a lot of people understand the power of money. They understand the banking monopoly. They understand that people have what many people call the good old boy network, and it is mostly boys, by the way. The Council on Foreign Relations, the Trilateral Commission, the Royal Institute of International Affairs, the Round Table of Rome, or whatever it's called, I can't think of the other outfit. The Skull and Bones. These people all facilitate people. You can read books after books after books, validated books of people who, somebody like Carter gets in, and suddenly there's like 300 people from the Council on Foreign Relations are in top positions in the government. And every president, almost every president that I know in my lifetime were literally puppets. They're being controlled by people behind the scenes. And, I said to myself when I was way into this and really beginning to understand things, I said to myself, why do these people persist? Why do they want world domination in the totalitarian police state, essentially a collectivist society like the communist society or the Nazis or whatever, the isms I call them? How much money can they spend? How much power can you wield? And I said to myself, what is it that drives these people generation after generation after generation? What is it they seek? Well, other than world dominion, I finally have decided with all my readings, and I know way, way more than I ever write or talk about, I finally decided that the one thing that they're striving for is knowledge. They will have it, and we won't. So get ready for another Dark Ages once they take over the world, because that's how it will be. Of course, they've all already said openly that they want to kill off about 80% of the people on this planet, so get ready for that, too.
Well, Professor Carol Quigley talked about the long-term plan of moving us towards a feudalistic society with the very few having the everything, and then the rest of us being slaves and serfs.
It's not possessions. I think the big thing will be knowledge. I mean, they might get to live to 300 years while we live 50. They might be able to cure cancer while we die of it. There's been talk for quite a while that there's actually a self-perpetuating electric generation that exists now. So it has for a long time. They've just kept it under wraps.
Yeah,
there's a lot of things
Tesla.
That come out under NASA and military intelligence knowledge that has been kept from us. It has been for decades and decades.
I heard Mark Kornke today mention that when they were talking about restricting the librarians they were requesting that the librarians in certain libraries remove about 500 different history books.
I'm going to tell you a story about history. Diverging a little bit here, but it follows along with the issue you just raised. One of the things I'm going to do in this next piece I'm writing is going to be on communism. And actually, it was part of my EU and the NAU two peas in a pod, but it got so big that I had to take it out. And I've been going to write this communism piece forever, and I'm finally going to do it in the next couple of weeks. I'm going to start. But I learned something. G. Edward Griffin, I don't know if you know who he is. He's the man that wrote The Creature from Jekyll Island about the Fed, the creation of the Fed.
Mm-hmm.
He's a wonderful man. He's been a documentarian for probably 40 or more years. But I stumbled onto a documentary that he did with a man by the name of, let's see if I can dredge this up. I can't think of his name right now. But he was part of the Rees Commission, R-E-E-S-E, which was a House Commission. He was acting as the legal counsel, guiding them so that they didn't make legal boo-boos while they were running this commission. But the purpose of the Rees Commission was to investigate nonprofits. And one of the nonprofits that they were going to pick on was the Carnegie Foundation, okay, the Peace and Something they call themselves. I just call them the Carnegie Foundation. And because this person, gosh, I wish I could give him Tom something. I can't think of his name right now. It'll come to me. Oh, Norman Dodd. That's it. That's his name, Norman Dodd. Just before he died, G. Edgar Griffin did an interview with him about the Rees Commission and what they discovered. The Rees Commission was looking in, as I said, to nonprofits because they had a feeling that they were, you know, subversive organizations in our country, and they are. The Ford Foundation, the Carnegie Foundation, the Rockefeller Foundations, all of them, they're subversive in our country. They are. They're anti-American subversives. But anyway, it turns out that Mr. Dodd, who I guess was pretty well off because he went to, you know, private schools and came out and became part of the banking industry, and he was in the banking industry during crash of 29. And he raised an important point after things sort of settled down about how that happened. And he brought that up to his boss, and his boss says, well, you know what, we're going to give you a task. You're going to go out and you're going to find out why this happened and how, so we can avoid it in the future. Well, he spent a year at his job, getting paid for his job, to investigate this. And he came up with this white paper, which he turned in. And they weren't happy with what they saw. And so I guess they made it tough for him, and he eventually offered his – oh, I'm sorry, that's what happened first. He gave them advice about stopping the another crash of 29. And they then gave him sort of a job in the back room where he was doing nothing, so he offered his resignation. So at that point, they said, oh, well, we don't want to take your resignation, but we want you to investigate and prove your hypothesis about what happened. So he did that. In the end, he left the banking industry, and he's working with the Rees Foundation. So he had these banking connections, okay? He knew people, the money people that are behind the shadow government, because it all takes money to run it. So when they were doing this investigation of the nonprofit, he used his background to segue himself into getting some insider information. And once the foundations found out that they were being investigated, they got very nervous. So they called Mr. Dodd to New York from Washington, D.C., and said, look, what can we do to get you, I mean, I'm going to put this very crudely, get you off our back? And he said, there is something you could do. And they said, what? This, again, was the Carnegie Foundation people. And they said, what? And they said, well, I would like to see the minutes of your meeting to the foundation. And I guess because the guy, he was relatively new as the head of the foundation and whatever, but he gave him permission to do it. So he went back to Washington, D.C., got a woman that was one of his staff persons. She was a lawyer, very bright woman, and he tasked her with going up and reviewing Carnegie Foundation's minutes of their meeting. And he sent her with a dictaphone. So dictaphone has these belts so that you can just speak into this thing and it records. There's old-fashioned stuff here. And she spent, I think she was allowed to have a certain period of time. I don't know whether it was 2 weeks or 4 weeks or what it was, but it was a fair amount of time. So he said, you're not going to be able to cover all their minutes at that point of time. And he said, so here, look, these are times, place when major events happened in the country. I want you to focus on them. Start with the very beginning to see what happened. Well, apparently after she did this task, came back, she was so destroyed by what she learned that was in those minutes to the foundation, the deviousness and the evil that was in that she literally came unglued psychologically and was never right after that. Eventually, even though they squirreled her away somewhere, with a job, you know, so she could earn a living to keep herself, she completely disintegrated mentally. But the upshot of it was what the very first meeting talked about around this first, the origination of the nonprofit Carnegie Foundation was the question. The question was, other than war, what can alter how a society behaves other than war? Well, after a year of discussion and back and forth, when they ended up, the final solution was, only war did that. Now, think about the war on terrorism. That was the most stunning thing I had ever heard in my life, that they actually talked about how they were going to go about changing society through war. What did they do in the 20th century? War after war after war. And you will find, if you follow the money, that the bankers made out on both sides of the war.
Yes, so. It is very lucrative business. War is the most lucrative business. And according to these, world domination types, the corporatocracy types, this is also the most rapid way to change society, is through the trauma,
exactly. The
trauma and terror of war. And so this has been used for over the last several centuries to great effect, and apparently with a long-term goal, as you say, a world monopoly.
And subjugation of the masses, because, you know, the USA Patriot Act is a perfect example. People have to realize that what brought Hitler to power? What brought Hitler to power in Germany was bringing order out of chaos, and he created the chaos. What are they doing here? They're having our country overrun with 30 million illegal aliens. They say now even as many as 38 million. They're not just here for allowing them in here for jobs and cheap labor and votes. They're in here to create chaos, and they're doing a darn good job of it.
Danine, I'm going to have to take a break here and do a station identification with KHEN LP 106.9 Salida. It's now 37, almost 38 degrees, and again, the opinions expressed by the host and guests on this show do not necessarily represent the views of KHEN, its staff, or board of directors, and this is Truth Quest with Eric Carlstrom and Melody, and our guest tonight is Danine Peterson, who is an expert on the North American Union and various subjects offshooting from that. Okay.
Yeah, yes, last week our guest Alan Watt also seemed to believe, or he stated that he thought that the ruling elite of the world works through foundations, they work through think tanks, they work through secret societies, and of course the semi-secret societies like Council on Foreign Relations and Trilateral Commission and Bilderberg Group and many others throughout the world.
And academia.
And I would be interested to hear how you say academia is involved as well, since I am in academia.
Well, you know, it's interesting. I always knew that academia was pretty well governed by liberal, leftist kind of people. Same way with the nonprofit world, for that matter. But I always felt, you know, okay, I can still believe what I believe. I don't have to believe what they believe, and I can still do my thing. And I never, ever thought to protect my own children as they went through, primary grades, junior high, and high school, because I thought, oh, well, they're not going to get exposed to this ultra-liberal left stuff, socialism, communism, whatever you want to call it, until they get to college. And by then, they'll have their feet on the ground, and they will have enough education and civic understanding and the Constitution and, you know, my upbringing and training and guidance to resist any kind of liberal leftist stuff. So I never worried about it. But then I read Charlotte Iserby's book, The Dumbing Down of America. And in it, she documents, it's the size of a phone book, she documents 50 years of gradual incremental control by communists, right straight out of the Communist Manifesto and the 10 Planks and so on and so forth, is what's in our schools today, our elementary and junior and senior highs. I had no idea. I was a very naive parent. I'm very sorry that I was. And as you probably already know, math and science and what have you has sort of fallen by the wayside. if it feels good, we'll do it. The whole attitude, you know, a fuzzy math. I mean, that's not just a name. That's actually happening, where you create your own way of doing math and things like that. Well, no wonder we don't have no wonder other countries are pouring out more mathematicians and scientists, et cetera, than we are per capita, because of what they're teaching our kids in the lower grades.
Yeah.
So it's eye-opening. Charlotte Eiserby, it's B-Y-R-T, but it should pronounce it with a B, like B-E at the end. It's called the Dumbing Down of America. It's stunning.
Would you say that the vision of George Orwell in 1984 or Aldous Huxley in Brave New World are more or less coming true? Would you say that these were pretty good?
Oh, sure. The Carol book, the two books that you just named, Atlas Shrugged. excuse me, all these people were insiders in one way or another. Anne Rand, by the way, who's the author of Atlas Shrugged, which I understand sits on the coffee tables of many, a gilded version of many of the shadow government people. It's sort of like a little emblem of their status. She was the paramour of one of the Rothschilds. For many, many years, even though she was married, and she wrote Atlas Shrugged because she knew these people, and just as you said, Orwell's 1984 and others, The War of the Worlds, all of them knew, and wrote what was supposed to have been fiction, but isn't really. It isn't really. And some of the quotes in 1984 are just like, if you read them today in the context under which I live now that I've educated myself, I'm like stunned, because they knew then. They knew then all about it.
And, of course, George Orwell, his real name was Eric Blair, was a Brit. He was an Englishman, and he would have had access to many of the ruling elite, I think. Must have been
absolutely.
Inside.
Yeah. Small country.
Yeah. Well, to shift gears a little bit here, some of the signs of the times in our own country that these kinds of things are coming down. You've talked about the North American Union as well as the SPP, the Free Trade Agreement of the Americas. But you haven't yet mentioned some of the recent laws that kind of presage a police state here, such as the Military Commission Act of 2006 and the National Defense Authorization Act of 2007. I know you mentioned these in some of your speeches. Could you tell us what the importance of these laws are?
They're not only very important, they're extremely frightening, because we have literally, through legislation and the consent of our Congress, both houses, we have literally created a dictator. I mean, I know that sounds far out, but when I cover what's in the Military Commissions Act and the National Defense Authorization Act, and the third of the triumvirate is called the National Security Presidential Directive, which was done in this year. Back on October 17th of 2006, there were two laws signed into law on the same date. The first was the Military Commissions Act of 2006, and that was done in a public signing. Now, what's in that? What's in that is the dissolution of the writ of habeas corpus. Now, according to the Constitution, the writ of habeas corpus cannot be done away with. And yet that's what this legislation, passed by the majority of our House and Senate and signed by the President, does. Okay? And in that, the Military Commissions Act also has what creates what they call a combatant status review tribunal, and or another tribe, this is a quote out of the MCA, that's the shorthand for Military Commissions Act, or another competent tribunal established under the authority of the President or the Secretary of Defense, in other words, he can just name it, which will enable the government to call you, and this is again in the Military Commissions Act, an unlawful enemy combatant, a person who has engaged in hostilities or who has purposefully and materially supported hostilities against the United States or its co-belligerents. Now, all the local news, all the national media, all the controlled media, I should call it, which is, again, another part of the North American Union, the complete control of the mainstream media, not talk radio, not the Internet, and, of course, they're working on trying to control the Internet, and not the independent newspapers, 40 of which they bought up in Texas to shut them up, 40 independent newspapers to shut them up because they were fighting against the TTC 35. So anyway, so what is the combatant status review tribunal? Well, the newspapers, the mainstream media said, oh, well, this is just for people that aren't Americans. It's not for American citizens. Well, you know what? They lied. This is right out of the Military Commissions Act. It says, quote, the term unlawful enemy combatant means a person, doesn't say a non-citizen or an alien or an illegal alien. It says a person who has engaged in hostilities or who has purposefully and materially supported hostilities against the United States or its co-belligerents, who is not a lawful enemy combatant. And how do they define a lawful enemy combatant? They say a lawful enemy combatant is someone, includes a person, this is again a quote, including a person who is part of the Taliban, the Al-Qaeda, or associated forces. They consider them lawful enemy combatants. Okay? Then it goes on to say, part two, a person who, before, on, or after the date of the enactment of the Military Commissions Act of 2006, has been determined to be an unlawful enemy combatant by a combatant status review tribunal or another competent tribunal established under the authority of the President or the Secretary of Defense. Notice that it does not contain an exception for Americans, and it throws a blanket over every citizen, an alien alike, by using the word person rather than alien. And the other thing is they can pick you up, put you before a tribunal, that's not a court, folks, and put you in jail and throw away the key, and you will have no way to get out, because that's what the writ of habeas corpus did. Habeas corpus, now most people know the second word, corpus, means a body. This means a body of law. It says the habeas corpus allows you to file a petition called the writ of habeas corpus that says, show me what law I broke. What evidence do you have? Prove to me that you have a right to keep me in this jail. Otherwise, when the writ of habeas corpus was available, you could petition the court and get those questions answered. And if they weren't answered in substance, you were let out of jail. Well, guess what, folks? You don't get out anymore. The writ of habeas corpus no longer exists.
And this is
now.
Go ahead.
One of the points is that people have to understand that it says specifically in our Constitution, in Article 1, Section 9 of the U.S. Constitution, it states, quote, the privilege of the writ of habeas corpus shall not be suspended unless when in cases of rebellion or invasion the public safety may require it. Well, gee, you know, I wonder if anti-war demonstrators would be considered rebellion. Gee, what about those hundreds of thousands of Hispanics that hit the street yelling sedition at the top of their lungs? Is that rebellion? Well, it certainly is, but I didn't see them move against them, did you? Because they want them there.
So
then the second law that was signed on the same day, but this one was done in a private ceremony. This is the National Defense Authorization Act of 2007. In that act, they did a couple of things. They said during there's two parts to this. One of the part was they revised part of the old Insurrection Act. They're now giving the authority of the president the authority to order the dispersal of either insurgents or those obstructing the enforcement of laws, and they renamed that section out of the Insurrection Act, the enforcement of the laws to restore public order. What this law did, the big thing, the number one thing that most people can relate to, is it did away with posse comitatus. Now, gee, when we are all yelling, let's put the troops down there on the border. Well, he finally did put the National Guard down there, but he didn't let them have their guns. They said, oh, but you can't do that because that's a violation of posse comitatus. There's always been that argument. Well, gee, we don't have to worry about that anymore because there's no more posse comitatus. Which means, if you will understand how posse comitatus law act came into place, it came into place after the end of the Civil War, when the Northern Army was sent to the South to act as policemen. And they did that for 15 years after the war ended. And it was pretty brutal. And the Southerners got tired of having the old jackboot on their neck, and so they went and got enough folks in Congress to pass the Posse Comitatus Law. And what the Posse Comitatus Law did, it did two things. One, it is says the well, of course, they didn't have an Air Force then, but the Army, the Navy, the Marines, and now, of course, the Air Force was forbidden to police, do any police duties, okay? Think about what police do. Think about what the military does. They were not allowed to act as policemen. In fact, MPs were trained. I used to live near two military bases, McGuire Air Force Base and Fort Dix Army Base. The MPs were trained to make sure they kept that division of posse comitatus between the military and police. Anytime they ran into a police situation, it was turned over to the police to handle. The military police weren't allowed to touch it. So now we've done away with that. The other thing that happened is the National Guard and the Coast Guard were left under the aegis of the governors of the state. So there was a division between the federal and the state. The state got to control the Coast Guard and the National Guard. And, of course, the federal government controls the military. Well, guess what? If you'll recall, during Katrina down in New Orleans, when Governor Blanco and President Bush, actually Karl Rove and Governor Blanco, had a big tug of war over what? The National Guard. And Rove wanted to have them called out on his command and controlled by the federal government. And Governor Blanco said, oh, no, no, no. This is local. This is my state. I control the National Guard. I'll say when they get called out, what they do, and where they go. Well, they didn't like that. So that's another reason why this is in the National Defense Authorization Act, that now they are all under the control of the President of the United States, the military, and the Coast Guard, and the National Guard. Whereas before, there was there's a states' rights issue violation here, is what's happened. So one of the things that people don't understand is that when the Patriot Act was created, and what do we talk about the Patriot Act? We always call it the USA Patriot Act. But I bet there's a lot of people out there that don't understand that the real name of the USA Patriot Act is the following: Uniting and Strengthening America by Providing Appropriate Tools Required to Intercept and Obstruct Terrorism Act of 2001. Well, there's a couple of things that you need to know about the Patriot Act. One of them is that this act, a large portion of this act, actually was put into law in 1996. But it was under attack for being in violation of our Constitution. Now, this is pre-9/11. Didn't you wonder how within a matter of weeks this enormous, thick, fat bill was on the president's desk for signature? Well, that's because most of it already existed before. And don't you love the title? Somebody used the acronym USA Patriot to create that title.
Very
Orwellian.
So are Orwellian.
We being manipulated or not?
That's Orwellian in the extreme.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's the opposite of patriotic. And yet, and of course, we've heard many times that members of Congress didn't even have time to read the bill before they were more or less strong-armed mm-hmm. into passing it. So only one or two people, including Ron Paul, voted it down. But it was mm-hmm. It was a tremendous atmosphere of fear. They were not given a chance to read it. So in a sense, we have created a dictatorship in this country. And mm-hmm. George Bush, when he took power, said, gee, this would be a lot easier if I was a dictator. if it was a dictatorship, as long as it was me.
Well, oh, you know, how many times has he said that, too?
Yes, he has. And so we now have a dictatorship in this country. But an interesting question occurs to me, Deneen, and that is that if we proceed along the course towards a North American Union, which seems to be coming down the pike fairly fast within the next couple of years, 3 years, whatever, what happens to the dictatorial powers of the U.S. president? Does that then extend over the whole union?
Oh, yes. And, you know, I'll tell you, Canada is absolutely, I mean, the people that know what's going on in Canada with the North American Union, they're petrified because they know darn well, geez, when Bush went up there to Montebello for this last trilateral meeting, the U.S. Army went with him. I was actually invited up there to speak at an event 1 day prior to them actually meeting on the 20th and 21st of August. And they picked a venue, something like, I don't know, kilometers and miles. I think it's like 3 to 1 or something like that. But it was 12 kilometers away from where Bush and them were going to meet. Well, they got kicked out of that venue because the military wanted a big perimeter. I mean, what they really didn't want is they didn't want these people getting together and talking about the Security Prosperity Partnership, the North American Union, and all the secrecy, and the fact that the American military was in Canada. That really ticked a lot of Canadians off, which I don't blame them.
I'm sure they
would be upset
sensitive
if the Canadians came down here and policed our country. But anyway, as far as this National Defense Authorization Act, the posse comitatus part of it is just a small part of it. What you have to understand where the dictatorial power comes in is also part of this act, and I will read you this little bit here. In the revision of that, as I said, the Insurrection Act, the president is now have permission to deploy troops as a police force, that's what's written in the bill, quote, during a natural disaster, think Katrina, during an epidemic, think the bird flu, during a serious public health emergency, well, that could be a dirty bomb or the bird flu or any other kind of health emergency, a terrorist attack, that could be a dirty bomb, but here is the barn door. He can deploy troops as a police force for other conditions. That's what's written in there. He's supposedly been given permission to do that during a natural disaster, an epidemic, a serious health, public health emergency, terrorist attack, or other conditions. When the president determines that the authorities of the state are incapable of maintaining public order, you know, think FEMA in New Orleans. Didn't a lot of people wonder how, after all these years of FEMA rushing to the scene and bringing order out of chaos and getting people their ice and water and facilities to live in, like the four hurricanes crossed over Florida in one summer. And they did just fine. All these years, FEMA did fine. And how come they fell apart so badly during Katrina? Gee, I wonder if it was to create the National Defense Authorization Act.
Interesting. Interesting.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I actually have documented proof that the FEMA people went into facilities that were set up by local first responders in the New Orleans area, the outer perimeter of the New Orleans area. They had communications set up, what have you. FEMA actually came in and cut their communication lines. FEMA actually turned back truckloads and truckloads and truckloads of water and sent them on routes across the country just to not accept their water. They told people that, I mean, down in the New Orleans area, if you've ever been there, everybody owns a boat. I mean, it might just be a canoe. Well, not a canoe. They don't have canoes there, but it's some small little batu, okay? Everybody has boats because there's water everywhere. Well, they wanted to go in there and rescue some of these people with these boats. Private citizens just said, oh, I volunteer. No, nope. FEMA said, nope, stay out of there. Mm-mm, no, you can't do that. Why did they do that? Why did they do that? People drowned because they didn't have, you know, they tried to find their own way out through the water and slipped and fell or whatever. Why did they do that? They did that to create the chaos to bring forward these kinds of bills, just like the Patriot Act was brought forward.
So this is kind of the Hegelian dialectic, thesis, antithesis, and synthesis, or problem, reaction,
yes,
solution,
mm-hmm,
that we've heard now more about recently,
mm-hmm,
where the government or the agents of the government or the secret government creates the problem. They're, mm-hmm, there with the solution, which allows them more complete police control of the situation. Yeah.
Problem, reaction, solution.
Yeah. Yeah.
Then here's another thing. As part of that Defense Act, the Pentagon was provided an additional $500 billion plus to enable the president to employ the use of the armed forces in major public emergencies. And to give you an example of how well they prepared for this, one whole year prior to the signing of the military, the National Defense Authorization Act, I found this little bit of information in a military newspaper. And you don't write in the military newspaper unless you have permission from the government. And this was written on October the 1st, so that was like 17 days before the National Defense Authorization Act was signed. And this is what it says. The U.S. Army North, the Army's newest service component command, reached full operational capacity Monday, which means that it is fully manned, equipped, and ready to assume its mission. As part of the Army transportation, USAR North was formed to become the dedicated Army Service Component Command to Northern Command, and or as they call it, NORTHCOM, the unified command responsible for defending the homeland. Oh, golly, I wonder why they're not down on the border. Defending the homeland and coordinating defense support of civil authorities. And guess where it's located? It's in Fort Sam Houston, Texas. USAR North achieved initial operating capability September in 2005 and is responsible for specific missions. Now, 2005, the National Defense Authorization Act didn't get signed until November 16th of 06. But this was started up in 2005. They're there to execute homeland defense and defense support of civil authorities, which means FEMA. They're there to conduct army-to-army portion of the theater in cooperative missions with Canada and Mexico. Did you know that? They're to coordinate the activities of defense coordinating officers and their elements assigned to each of the federal management emergency regions in the country. For the past 12 months, USAR North has been building its organizational readiness and mission capability. USAR North officially assumed the Army Component Command duties from Forces Command on October 1st, 2006. So, now you know.
$500 billion is a lot of money to spend on this militarization of the homeland here.
Well, they're busy building a police state. Then he followed that. Now, I told you that the part of the National Defense Authorization Act said that he could bring forth martial law, because see, one of the things you have to understand when you say deploy troops as a police force, that's martial law, just in case I left that out, which I think I did. If the federal government deploys troops as a police force, that is martial law, okay? Well, there was a small problem. There was a little loophole there. And so Bush turned around, and let me see if I see the date on this, when this actually was done. Sorry, I don't. It was in this year. It turns out that there was a small loophole. And that loophole was that if anything happened, like a Katrina, like 9/11, two major events, or something even worse than that, it would still pretty much be a local event or within a state, okay, or maybe even involving two states. Like there's big forest fires and things like that that cross over state boundaries. But it would be a local thing, local in relation to the entire massive size of the continental United States. Well, Bush didn't like that. So he sat down and he wrote this National Security Presidential Directive. Well, that's sort of like executive orders, but it's a little bit slightly different. But he sits at his desk and he writes these up. Not he doesn't, but, you know, somebody does. It also had a component part having to do with it was just another name for the same law. And what happens is under this NSPD is he closed the loophole. And here's the loophole. The loophole was that if he tried to call out nationwide martial law, I think people would get mighty upset about that. Say we had another 9/11, okay, or a couple of dirty bombs released in a couple of states. he would only be, I don't think the people in this country, the general populace of this country, would allow him to call nationwide martial law for a local event, even if it involves a whole state or two states. So he wrote this National Security Presidential Directive 51, which now says, and I'll read this to you, the NSPD 51 directly loosely defines catastrophic emergency as any incident, and this is the part, regardless of location, that results in extraordinary levels of mass casualties, damage, or disruption severely affecting the U.S. population, infrastructure, environment, economy, or government function. Well, that definition would have applied to 9/11 as far as casualties affecting U.S. population. Damage affecting infrastructure could be Katrina. Damage affecting the environment could also be Katrina. Disruption of severely affecting the U.S. Economy could be 9/11. I mean, what happened to the stock market and all of that? What about when the Ohio River Valley and Mississippi River flooding several years back? That was a huge economic impact to that. Disruption of government functions, that could be a Katrina, that could be a 9/11. Those are just recent examples of things that would fit this description. And he can call out martial law nationwide on any single event like that. That's what this NSPD 51 did. Is anybody standing in our Congress saying, you can't do that, you're turning yourself into a dictator? Nope.
You know, I think a lot of people, when they hear the word martial law, they don't have a real vivid impression of what that would entail. Could you kind of surmise what that would look like?
Oh, sure. Anybody that's ever traveled on an interstate, when you travel on an interstate and there's an accident, what do? They shunt you off the interstate and they close off exits. Well, let's see. If martial law was done, any of the interstate areas, they could simply close off all exits and force you to go off in certain places. They can stop you and detain you. For instance, there was supposed to be a truckers' protest down in Washington, D.C. when this first information came out about the Mexican truckers coming in here. And what do? They cut them off at each of the, because there's limited access to interstates. The police actually turned back truckers. If they couldn't show a manifest that said that they were going into the heart of D.C. to deliver a load, they weren't allowed to get on that highway. So that's some of the ways. There are actual training exercises going on across this country. One would just happen out in Oregon State, I believe, and one of our protectorates. I'm not forgetting which one.
Guam.
It wasn't Guam. It might have been Guam. The Seychelles, people like that. Anyway, they're putting on these exercises where they're combining FEMA and the local first responders and the military all together. There are small towns around here that are literally trained how to cut off all access to a town. They're trained to do that. Well, when martial law comes in place, they'll all be backed up by the military. All right? Yes, they will use it to literally create mini prisons out of towns. And they've created the plans. Some of them have actually practiced enacting them.
Detention centers.
I have a video on my website that's very telling.
The detention centers?
Pardon?
Are you talking about detention centers? Things like that?
Oh, yes. Well, I didn't get that far in this description.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
There are detention camps in this country. I do have a letter in, by the way, I'm skipping over a lot of stuff because I see time is winding down, but I wrote an article called The Two Acts of Tyranny on the Same Day, and that's these two acts, the Military Commissions Act and the National Defense Authorization Act. So if you missed or don't understand what I'm saying or you want a fuller description of what happened, it's in that article. One of the things that's in the article is a photographic copy of this. It is actually a photograph. You won't even be able to copy it. You'd have to just be able to read it. This was written in 1997 by a member of Congress by the name of Bill Hefner, and he's responding to a constituent who wrote him and asked him about these camps. And he says in his letter to his constituents, enclosed is the information you requested pertaining to the Army's policy and guidance for establishing civilian inmate labor programs and civilian prison camps on Army installations. This information has not yet been published, and then in parentheses it says, it is currently at the printers. However, it has been funded, staffed, and does reflect current Army policy. I hope you find this information useful. Does well, that, think about just a couple years back, all the hue and cry over the BRAC closings. Why, if we need more troops, we don't have enough military personnel to do the job that we're doing illegally around the world, why would we close bases? Why are we doing that? I guess it's because we have a bases in 130 countries around the world. That's kind of scary. But why would we do that? These are already established government-owned land military bases, and people employed there. Whole towns depending on these various bases that exist around the country, and they closed. I don't know how many. I have a file about 7 or 8 inches thick on all the BRAC closings that were done. Why? What are they doing? Well, they're turning them into detention camps. And I have one video on my website that shows a detention camp, and it points out all the things that lead you just by looking. Lead you to understand that it's being created for detention of people. The size of the spaces allotments by the numbers along the fence, the way the barbed wire is pointing in and not out, keeping people in as opposed to keeping people out of the facility. Excuse me, different facility changes that were made to standing buildings, the bricking up of huge openings and the turnstile fences for getting through, the kind that you can get through but you can't come back out of. You know, you've been in train stations and stuff where they have them. Different parts of the facility, they just put it on the thing and they ask why this, why that, why this, why that. There's rail lines coming in. Supposedly there's 800 of these. I don't think there are 800. But there are lists, and again, they're in that article that I told you about, the two acts of tyranny on the same day, where people have maintained that there are, and they go to these bases and they see these things. They've documented some stuff. I say it's your civic duty out there in the United States. If you live near some of these closed bases, go look. Take your camera. Take your video camera. See what you can see. Verify if some of the ones that are on the list, because they name them on this list. Where they're located in the country, the names of the bases, and where they're physically located. Go look. Verify it. Or, you know, get in touch with these people and tell them they're full of hooey. And I say it's part of your civic duty to do that. Don't just sit back and say, oh, I don't believe that.
Wasn't there some legislation called Rex 84 that kind of paved the way for this? Are you familiar?
Rex 84, yes. That was an old exercise that was done. Again, a lot of these things that are done by the military now, these practice exercises, are done without the consent of the local governance. That and Garden Plot was another one. That's actually all in that Two Acts of Tyranny thing. You can read about that, and you look at the citations and go to the source material. And like I say, that list is in there. Yeah, you can. That's all in there.
And under martial law, when the Bill of Rights is no longer applicable to American citizens, it would be then possible to round up American citizens for any reason and put them in these concentration camps, I guess. Is this
absolutely. I call them gulags. Yeah.
Gulags. So we could be looking at American gulags. So what happened in Germany under Hitler and Russia under Stalin could happen here.
Well, part of this the National Defense Authorization Act says that the president can actually require that people be relocated to parts of the country where their labor is needed. And now, is that a thinly veiled concentration camp or not?
Okay, so when you're talking about the North American Union and all these different acts, what is the purpose of, you know, rounding up the people if they're doing these so-called trade trade agreements and that sort. I mean, what is give? I mean, you'd mentioned a little bit briefly about, you know, population control and things like that. I mean, give us kind of an overview of why all, where all this ties in.
Well, do you think you'd be able to take any weapons with you when you go to these concentration camps? Or they relocate you for working in other parts of the country? I don't think so. One of the things, of course, you know, again, this is a UN agenda, et cetera. They want us disarmed. They want us disarmed. How better to do that than collect you? The president has come out and said he wants churches to act as temporary detention centers while they, you know, corral and collect people. They want the churches to participate in that. I mean, it's see what the problem is, and this is the problem for me. I'm one of these kind of people. I'm a Bible-believing Christian, and I cannot fathom the evil that is behind what's going on. It took me a long. I have literally lost my innocence about the goodness and kind-heartedness of mankind, because not everybody has a good core way, way, way down deep, even though they've done some dumb things in their life. There are truly evil people, and they are running our country. And so when we look at something, we read it as one way, just like the corridors issue. We think a corridor, well, that's just another name for a road. Well, no, it's not. Not for them. And so there's a whole lot of things that they do. Now they're calling these detention camps. Well, for what reason? They said, and they've said this repeatedly, this has been in the mainstream press. They said, well, we're going to go out there and we're going to round up all those illegal aliens. And we have to have someplace to stick them while we process them to deport them back to their countries. I don't think so. I don't think so. Why haven't they done it? They're already in existence, these detention camps. No, they're for us. And they're for us when military law arrives.
Okay, well, thank you for the explaining the martial law and the implications of martial law. Again, I think most Americans have a hard time envisioning this or thinking about it even. We've lived awfully well, most of us in our lifetimes, relative to all humanity. The United States has been a very wealthy country. So it's hard to imagine the American people falling so far so fast. And I think that's one of the reasons that people are not up in arms, because they are living fairly well. Most Americans, but to get these kinds of ideas, a lot of people, you're not going to get them from the mainstream press. They have to research it, they have to look, and they have to dig. And a lot of people would rather be entertained, and I'm afraid that's one of our big problems right now.
Well, yes, in fact, I will tell you, I have not. My television set has been off for, I guess it's now 18 months. I don't watch television at all. It's a shame, because back in 1948, my parents were one of the first people to have a television set. For years, my mother worked at RCA. I probably had one of the first color television sets that were ever out, even though there was only one channel with a turkey with his tail fanned out with the different colors on it years and years ago when they first came out. I turned it off because I realized that even though it was one of the greatest inventions of the 20th century, it was also one of the most diabolical, because they have used it as a propaganda tool very well. They've used it to dumb down and brainwash people. The whole issue of the fall of the Roman Empire, and as the empire crumbled, what were people doing? They were down in the Colosseum with circuses and fun and games and what have you. Well, what do we have today? Well, we have all these video games, and we have different contests and lots of sports, and to keep people entertained, to mesmerize them, to brainwash them, to... I mean, back in the 1950s, they started calling the television the boob tube for a very good reason.
Yeah.
Because it's dumbing down America.
Well, it certainly is. And, of course, people get their worldview. They get their facts, or what they think are facts. They get their fundamental way to look at the world from the media. And I recently discovered through just talking with an old friend that whether one listens to AM or FM, makes a radical difference in how you look at the world. And my friend, who is a smart guy, likes to listen to Rush Limbaugh, and he has a completely different worldview, as you can imagine. And then say somebody who listens to NPR, and mm-hmm. with TV, as you say, it really has become the Orwellian box, the propaganda mm-hmm. machine, which keeps Americans from seeing reality, I'm afraid now.
Absolutely.
So, I agree.
I have an interview on my video page between Aaron Russo, who created America from Freed of Fascism, and those of you who have seen that. It's an interview where he discusses his personal relationship with one of the Rockefellers.
Right.
And talking about how the Rockefellers were deliberately behind the women's movement. They said, yeah, we wanted to get those women out into the marketplace where we could now get taxes from both the husband and the wife. And we could get our hands on the kids because they'd have to put them in the government schools.
Yeah.
This is true. This is real life. This is really what happened. They're now talking about Gloria Steinem having her magazine and everything was financed by the CIA. Wake up, people!
Okay, so I think we've done a pretty good job of outlining some of the major, serious, and dangerous issues that face us. Could you, in the last little time we have here, maybe we could start to talk about what we can do, what you think might... the American people still have a lot of power, perhaps. What can we do as citizens to reclaim our country?
Well, I'm glad you asked me that question, but I do have one more little piece that I have to get in because you had asked me about how are they going to do this martial law. Well, here's what you have to understand. Once the military is out in control and we have our little gulags and places to send people who are dissidents, or protesters, or whatever, they've been practicing on that. The different conventions where people have come to protest, and how they've caged them off, and have blimps flying overhead, and helicopters, and what they call microwave crowd control equipment, what have you. They're practicing. The airports. I say the airports are a perfect example of how the police state will function with little rabbit rails and checking all your luggage and making you throw out your hairspray and lipstick and everything else and toothpaste. And it's all practice. You already have a police state literally in your airport. I mean, I'm just giving that as an analogy. I'm not saying it is a police state, but it's very much like a police state.
I totally agree.
Some idea what can happen, how a few people who are in control control hundreds and hundreds of people. All right? But here's the real way they're going to control you. Again, these are executive orders. They have come out from Bush Sr. They've come out from Clinton. They ride on other ones prior to that. They incorporate them into one big omnibus executive order. What are executive orders? Well, two people described what executive orders are, and these are people that should know. One is Paul Begala. He was a former Clinton advisor. This was in the New York Times in July of 98. He said, what are executive orders? He said, stroke of the pen. Law of the land, kind of cool. Yes, when the president writes an executive order, it goes into the Federal Register, and if our Congress does not object to it within a certain period of time, and I will tell you, I tried to get to the bottom of this as a researcher, I was very frustrated. Some people say within 30 days, some say within 60 days, and others say within 90 days. If the Congress does not object, whatever he writes at his desk, an executive order, no matter what it says on it, they have that period of time after it gets into the Federal Register, which will be the next day after he signs it, to object. And if they don't object, it is law. So guess what? According to our Constitution, the only people that are supposed to create laws is our Congress. Okay? But yet, the president does it with executive orders now. There's one order that should terrify you all, and that is called Executive Order 12919. The President of the United States, with the help of federal agencies that will have control over the following items. This is one executive order if and when martial law – there's one more person who said – this is Interior Secretary Bruce Babbitt. Some of you may remember him. Washington Times, 1999. He says – we've switched the rules of the game. We're not trying to do anything legislatively. That's funny. Because what he's saying is, we're going to bypass the Congress. The executive is just going to write executive orders, and that's how laws will arrive in our country. And they're doing a darn good job of it, by the way. Here's the one, this 12919. if and when martial law comes to play, these executive orders will automatically invoke. This one order tells you what kind of control they're going to have and how they're going to do it. It's not just going to be troops marching up and down the street. It's not going to be troops denying you access or entry or travel arrangements. This is what will happen. It will affect every aspect of your life, everything. The federal government will then be able, will control all transportation regardless of ownership. They will control all forms of energy. And they make a list. There's a list of four or five lines, you know, including petroleum, gas, natural manufactured electricity, solid fuels, atomic energy. Every way we could produce any energy, they will have control over that. They will have a say. The military can go there and say, do this, do this, do this, do this, all right? They will control all farm equipment, whether you own it or not, doesn't matter. Anything that's involved in the production or preparation for market use of food or resources, like they did that in Russia. The farmers would literally work for the government. They will control all fertilizer. They will control all food resources. Anything that's ingested by human beings or animals. I mean, that covers, you know, a lot of territory. And then they list, you know, all the things, starches and sugars and vegetables and animal and marine fats, cotton, tobacco, and so on. It goes on. There was a comment made at one time by the UN World Food Program, and this was in Beijing, and this is by a woman at a meeting in Beijing, the UN's Fourth World Conference on Women in September of 1995. She said, food is power. We use it to change behavior. Some may call that bribery. We do not apologize. And then there was the famous Kissinger, or I should say infamous Henry Kissinger statement. He said, food can be used as a weapon. Now, you don't need guns and bullets if you control the food supply, folks. You don't need military men marching in the street if you control the food supply. They will also control all food resource facilities, plants, machinery, vehicles, etc., distribution of food storage, livestock and poultry feed and seed, and so on. They will control all health resources. That means everything, you know, from materials to facilities to supplies to blood collecting, dispensing, surgical, blah, blah, blah. It goes on and on. It lists all the items. This is all in this executive order, 129.19. Get on the Internet. Read it. It also covers all metals and minerals. That includes gold and silver. And if you'll remember, back in the 30s, then they confiscated all gold and silver. And lastly, they will also control all water resources. All usable water from all sources within the jurisdiction of the United States. All water that can be managed, controlled, and allocated to meet emergency requirements.
Well, how does that come in then with the UN trying to get the land... Law of the Sea Treaty. Is the UN going to be fighting it out with the government, or are they one capitulating?
Well, sure. It's total world control that they want. The United Nations is just part of the facilitation of that. The North American Union, the EU, the African Union, the Asian Union, all of those things will come together. Little by little, incrementally, over time, from the bottom up, is how they are taking every bit of this. And why we don't know about it, and most places don't know about it, because of the control of the media. People have come to me and said, you know what, we need to have a coup down there in Washington, D.C. And I said, no, we don't need to have a coup in Washington, D.C. We need to have a coup in the mainstream media. Because if we are the many, they are the few. And that's the only saving grace as far as we're concerned. And if the people in this country actually knew what was going on, because the media was transparent, honest, and truthful, and told us what was going on in this country, they wouldn't be able to do what they're doing. But because people don't know, you can't rise up against something you don't know anything about. I mean, I have a whole list of ways, all the way back in the 1930s, where they actually plotted and planned to take control of the media in this country. They have been working for 60 years. To control the media the way they do it today.
Oh, I think longer than that, Deneen. From what I understand,
J.P. Morgan
bought up the top 25 newspapers in 1917 or 13, one of those two. So, yeah, this has been a long-term plan.
mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah, here it is. Actually, this goes all the way back to 1980. This is really a perfect example. It says one night, this has been well documented, and I followed it right back all the way down to the original source. John Swinton, he was a preeminent New York journalist who was a guest of honor at a banquet given him by the leaders of his craft. Someone who knew neither the press nor Swinton offered a toast to the independent press, and Swinton outraged his colleagues by saying, "There is no such thing." Now, this man was the editor-in-chief of the New York Times, the Gray Lady. So he knew what he was talking about. He said, "There is no such thing. At this date," this is 1880, "of the world's history in America as an independent press, you know it and I know it. There is not one of you who desires to write your honest opinions, and if you did, you know beforehand that it would never appear in print. I'm paid weekly for keeping my honest opinion out of the paper I'm connected with. Others of you are paid similar salaries for similar things, and any of you who would be so foolish as to write an honest opinion would be out on the streets looking for another job. If I allowed my honest opinions to appear in one issue of my paper, before 24 hours, my occupation would be gone. The business of the journalist is to destroy the truth, to lie outright, to pervert, to vilify, to fawn at the feet of mammon, and to sell his country and his race for his daily bread. You know it, and I know it. And what folly is this toasting an independent press? We are the fools and vassals of rich men excuse me, behind the scenes. We are the jumping jacks. They pull the strings, and we dance. Our talents, our possibilities, and our lives are the property of other men. We are intellectual prostitutes."
Wow. That's a great quote. But what can we do, Deneen? Can you give us some rays of optimism and hope here?
Yes, I can. And I wrote an article which I have on my website. I have a button that says what you can do, okay? And there's lots of things you can do. One of them is, and I got a chance to talk with Virgil Good down in Washington, D.C. when I was down there giving a speech. And I made a commitment to him to promote, and I try to do this every program that I'm on, he has a resolution. It's called the House Concurrent Resolution 40, also called H. Conres 40 or HCR 40. You can look it up under those names, where he actually sponsored and has now, I think, close to 40 co-sponsors for it. At the time I talked to him about this, we only had about 23. And what they're doing is they are saying that they have to stop doing the SPP, the Security Prosperity Partnership, and the North American Union. And so he needs more co-sponsors. And what I tell people is they need to hound their federal House of Representatives person in their district throughout the country to get them to sign on as co-sponsors on the HDR 40.
Okay.
Get on the Internet. Look up who are your local federal government people are and get them. Then there's another one. You know, and really, that's what real sovereignty is about. They're our servants. We are not their servants. They are our servants. They're supposed to do our bidding, okay? Then there are 19 states in this country right now, and I will say one of the good things that has come out of all the things that have happened is we're seeing more and more states take back their states' rights, which have really literally fallen by the wayside over the decades. And there are some 19 states that are saying, stop the SPP, stop the NAU. There's a great website you can go to. It's called Stop the NAU, and right on their homepage they show the 19 states that already have either passed both houses and signed, or in one house or another, or at least have the law proposed and working its way through their different political systems. I mean, not every state's legislature meets year-round. Very few big industrial states do, but all the rest have very shortened congressional years, calendar years. And so, but there is a way actually to petition your state to put one of those laws on the books for that state and again, reinforce states' rights, which have really fallen by the wayside. And that the way you do that is by using there's also people out petitioning, and several states have signed on to stopping the Real ID, which is the driver's license situation, the national driver's license that they want to create. And again, that's another step on the road to the North American Union. They want all these databases connected from state to state to state. The state of North Carolina is already issuing driver's licenses with North American continent on it in a hologram on the back of the driver's license. They're going to put RFID chips in them, and you'll be able to, they'll be able to, you know, read your chip as you walk past these different readers. But anyway, I have a video on the website that actually shows, it's a documentary, which shows how to go about petitioning your state for either stopping the SPP-NAU resolution or stopping the Real ID. And they're already, I'm going to say there's at least 11 states now, I think, have signed laws. They won't go along with this. It's really, the Real ID is a national ID card. Denise, and they're using your driver's license to get it. Well, there was a big to-do here in New York State about Governor Spitzer giving driver's license to illegal aliens. We thought that was a good move. Did that, by the way, with an executive order.
It sounds like we needed a little bit more time even tonight to cover all the, the aspects of this thing, and I really appreciate you coming on.
Thank you for all your work.
Yes, and again, I, you know, we may have you back up here again soon so that we can...